Hey everyone, well last week we started our journey through the book of Ruth, and you can turn there now, get ready to take some notes and interact with the scriptures today. You know, we like to think of the Bible around here as a life textbook, and so we'll mark it up and we'll capture our learnings and our life with God as we go. But if you missed last week, you can catch up with the message at the Sermon Archive section of our website or in our app or podcast, but I'm going to do a quick summary of chapter one here so that we're all on the same page. The book of Ruth is one of the greatest short stories in all of history. We found out last week that it takes place during the time of the judges. It was a time of great sin and rebellion and folly, and one of the darkest periods in the history of God's people. The story tells us that in Bethlehem of Judah, there was a family, an ordinary family, a husband, Elimelech, wife, Naomi, and two Star Trek Klingon boys named Malon and Kilion. Right? This was supposed to be the perfect family. An adventurous husband, not one, but two sons. And as we said last week, in a male-dominated society, boys were the key to both success and security. But the story turns south, because in Bethlehem, which means the house of bread, there was a famine. And this was God's judgment. And when you're in the house of bread and you run out of bread, what you're supposed to do is to repent and to turn back to God. But what this family did was to run away. And they didn't just run to anywhere. They ran to Moab, the home of evil, perverse, and pagan people. This was a tragic mistake. And they began to experience the consequences of abandoning God and his people. I think of Proverbs 16:25 that says, "There's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death." And that's what happened to this family. The two sons end up marrying Moabite women named Orpah and Ruth. And soon the father, Elimelech, and both sons die. And the mother, Naomi, is left broken and alone in a pagan country with two pagan daughters-in-law. And so she gets word that the famine is ending back in Bethlehem, and she decides that the best way forward is to do the walk of shame back home. She encourages her daughters to stay put in Moab with their families, where they have the hope and the ability to get remarried and to have a home and a family, to have their futures restored. And Orpah takes her up on the offer to stay behind. But Ruth, in an incredible act of faith and friendship, says to Naomi, "If I stay in Moab, I might live, but my faith will die. And so I'm going to come with you to Bethlehem. I know we'll have nothing there, but I'll have faith, and I want your God to be my God. I know I'm going to be an immigrant, and I know I won't be wanted, and I know I'll face persecution and probably starvation and maybe even death, but I want to come with you. I want to follow your God." And so as they walk back into the town, Bethlehem, this is a little beehive of gossip, and Naomi is really bitter with God. In fact, she tells her old friends, "Don't even call me Naomi anymore," which means beautiful. "Just call me Mara," which means bitter. She said, "I'm a bitter old woman." She was angry at God. And it would have been very hard to believe that this story was going to turn out right if you just stayed in chapter one. But she made the critical decision to come back to God. She realized it was better when she was among God's people and under God's provision. And Naomi said, "You know, I'd rather put my faith in God than to live away from him." And so as I kept reminding you last week, it's only chapter one. It's only chapter one. And some of you need to hear that and believe that as you walk through your own difficulties in your own chapter one. God is still writing his story of redemption over your life. But for the moment, Ruth and Naomi find themselves at a dead end. And they've come to Bethlehem and the people are gossiping. And Naomi's too old to get work or to get married. Plus her head really isn't in the right place. She's mad at God. And Ruth is an immigrant with great work ethic, but from a hated people with no rights. And so they're at the end of the road. They're going to starve to death unless something happens. And we've got this great painting, and I think this painting up here captures the situation so beautifully. You know, they've come as far as they can go, and they're staring over the edge at this great unknown. They need God to do something. And some of you can relate to this painting. You find yourself at this very place today. There are no good options. There's no hope. There's no direction. And so chapter one ended with just a little bit of hope. It said, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. This is a cue to us that the famine has ended. And we're going to see God do his thing in chapter two. So we're going to start there in Ruth chapter two, starting in verse one. "Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz." So we're going to take some notes as we go today, and I just want you to circle the very first word of chapter 2. It's the word "now." Now, depending on your translation, it may say, it so happened. If it doesn't say that, I want you to write that in the margin. It so happened. That's the gist of this little word. And what we're finding here at the outset of chapter 2 is that we're being introduced to God's primary way of working supernaturally in our lives. A lot of people, when they think of God working supernaturally, they think of miracles, parting the seas, healing the blind, raising the dead. Those times when God suspends the laws of nature and demonstrates his undeniable power. Now listen, God still does this. But it is not the main way that he operates. The most common way that God works is through what theologians would call providence. Now, a simple definition of providence is simply this: God's demonstration of his control over all things through ordinary means. It's the times when God shows up to accomplish his will through normal activities and normal people. And we're going to see it over and over again in this chapter. In fact, our big idea today is simply this: God's invisible hand is always at work. So verse 1 tells us that it just so happened that there was a man named Boaz who was a relative of Naomi's husband. And it sounds like happenstance, it sounds like coincidence, but it's not. It's God's providence. You see, God's purposes are always on purpose. So here we see the invisible hand of a gracious God at work. I want you to listen to Psalm 37. Psalm 37, 23 says this: the steps of a man are established by the Lord when he delights in his ways. Another version says it this way: the Lord directs the steps of the godly. You see, God is involved in every detail of your life. God is powerful enough to work in our lives, but he's also personal enough to care about every single detail. I want to remind you that you are here today listening to this message under God's providential hand. He wants you here. He drew you here. He wants you to learn and grow and act in response to his voice. His invisible hand is at work even right now. Look at verse 2. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain, after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." And so she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. So God is at work here, guys, but so is Ruth. You know, she's not sitting around on Pinterest or, you know, watching reruns of, you know, the Real Housewives of Moab. She's gleaning leftovers from the field. Remember, she's an immigrant. And so the author is diligent to add the Moabite anytime we hear her name mentioned. He's reminding us that she's a foreigner. And when we think about immigration and immigrants, why would someone leave their home and everything that they know and move to another country? Almost always, it's for the hope of a better life. The life of an immigrant is very, very difficult, and more so in the ancient world. But listen, here's the difference. Ruth didn't leave for a better life. She left knowing that she would have a worse life. She could have had a better life, a more comfortable life back at her home. But she came to Bethlehem for two reasons. She's committed herself to God, and Ruth has committed herself to Naomi, her mother-in-law. And so with amazing devotion and a strong work ethic, she goes to the fields to provide food for them. She goes to glean. And this idea of gleaning was one of God's gracious provisions for those in need. It was his own version of social services, God's own kind of welfare system. He knew there would always be people in need, and so he told his people, if you have a good job, if you have lands and fields, then you go through and you just harvest it once. But stay away from the edges. Leave the edges of the field untouched for those in need. The immigrants, the fatherless, the widows. But God knew that their need wasn't just for food, but it was for dignity as well. And so he allowed them to work for their food. They would still have to go through the harvesting process on their own. And this assured that those who were willing to work would always have food, because those who had good jobs were commanded to be generous with their extra, but not just to give handouts. You know, I think there are lessons on all sides of that system that apply to us right now. But Ruth goes out to glean. And I want you to see the second part of verse 3. It says, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Did you hear that? There it is again in verse 3. She happened to come into the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. And if you circled in verse 1, circle again here in verse 3, this word happened. The author here is being ironic. This is not chance. This is not good karma. This is not Ruth's lucky day. What we're seeing here is God's invisible hand at work. His providence is at work. She happened into the field of Boaz. And so here we're introduced to this character, Boaz. Verse 1 says that he's a male relative of Naomi's dead husband, Elimelech. This is a very important detail that we'll explore more next week. The original readers would have heard this, the fact that he was a relative, and for the first time in this story, they would have seen hope for Ruth and Naomi. It's a way out. But we also see that Boaz is a worthy man. The description means that he was worthy of respect and honor. It also means that he's successful and wealthy. Boaz was a dude's dude, right? His name means mighty one. He's a man. He drinks his coffee black. He doesn't own a sweater vest. He's never even sat in a smart car. He's never hummed a Taylor Swift song, even under his breath. He's a dude. He is a good and godly man. And we're also going to find out that he's kind and gracious and generous. He's a good boss, all that stuff. But the proof is in the pudding. I mean, if you want to know a man's relationship with God, you can't just look at his Sunday church attendance. You need to find out how far God has saturated into the details of his everyday life. And so I want you to look at verse 4 because we're going to see how Boaz, the CEO, arrives at his workplace. Look at verse 4. It says, "And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, 'The Lord be with you.' And they answered him, 'The Lord bless you.'" All right, and so the boss pulls up in his BMW 5 Series. He gets out to check on his field, to see how his business is going, to check on his employees, and he steps out, and the first thing out of his mouth is he offers a prayer of blessing. How many of you at your workplace, your boss walks in and says, "The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with you all," and everybody pops up out of their cubicles like little moles, and they say, "No, sir, the grace of the Lord be with you." No, guys, heck, I work at a church. And we don't even do that here. In fact, the first words out of my mouth are usually like, "Hey, who burned the bagels again?" You know, or something really unspiritual like that. But Boaz is this true and godly man. He's not just spiritual in church. He brings God into his workplace. This is true faith. And whether you're an employer or an employee, we can learn from this. I would ask you, how concerned are you for the spiritual lives of the people that you work with? Because, guys, how you work says more about your Christian walk even than how you worship. And so he arrives and he looks out over his fields and he happens to notice a woman working there. Now remember, Ruth just so happened to stumble into Boaz's field that day and he just so happened to see her. And so in verse 5, he calls some intern over and he says, "Like, who's the girl out there?" And the intern explains, "Well, she's the Moabite woman who came home with Naomi. And she asked to glean in the fields." Now I want you to look at verse 8 as you'll see Boaz's kindness and provision for Ruth. It says, "Then Boaz said to Ruth, 'Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn.'" Listen, Boaz knew that for a Moabite woman to go out and glean in the field, she was taking her life into her own hands. He knew the kind of danger she was in. She could be killed. She could be raped, even by his men. Remember, the Moabites were seen as horrible, wicked people. So he didn't even want her out near the edges because he knew that she might be killed. And so Boaz essentially establishes the first sexual harassment policy maybe in history. He gathers his guys up together and he says, "Listen up, boys. You see this girl here? Yeah. If you so much as look at her wrong," well, let's put it this way. "I own lots of fields and they'll probably never find your body." Okay? And Boaz is protecting her, but he has no ulterior motives. Romance isn't even a possibility with her in his mind at this point. He is helping her because he's a godly man. His heart goes out to this immigrant woman who could be in danger. Look at verse 10. "And she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, 'Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?'" Now remember, this is the first encounter between these two. This would eventually turn into a marriage, okay? I mean, spoiler alert. but it didn't exactly start as a love connection. Ruth is desperate, yes, but she shows some real wisdom here in her response to Boaz. She doesn't say, "Hey, Boaz, nice to meet you. You want to go out for drinks? Do you want to know my ring size?" Right? She's not getting ahead of herself here. She's wisely just asking questions. Why are you doing this? What's in this for you, Boaz? Are you expecting something in return from me? Single ladies in the room, you need to ascertain whether that guy is being nice to you because he wants a good time in the near term or because he wants a good life in the long term. And we get a glimpse into Boaz's motives in verse 11 in the next couple verses. But Boaz answered her, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land, and you came to a people that you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So Boaz was intrigued with her because of her character. Listen, on the other side, she already has three strikes against her. She was a Moabite, a people who were hated by the Jews. She was widowed, which meant in that culture that she was used goods, and she was poor. She was in the field. She was in the equivalent in this moment of dumpster diving for food. And let's be honest, ladies. I mean, this isn't Ruth's finest moment, looks-wise, right? I mean, she's feeling hot, but not in the good kind of way. Like, she's sweaty and filthy and oily and grimy, and her one dress is ruined from rummaging through the fields all day. I mean, if you're looking for a romance, this isn't the setting you're hoping for to meet the man of your dreams. I mean, if you knew you were going to meet Boaz that day, like, you're going to disappear for a few hours into the bathroom, and you're sandblasting and spackling and spray painting, whatever you guys do in there. There are things that happen in there that the male mind can't even comprehend. But that's not why Boaz was intrigued at this point. He was taken by the beauty of her character as a woman who had great faith in God. He said, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law, Naomi, it's captured me." And guys, I want you to see for a moment how a godly man thinks, because there are so few examples of this for us anymore. He's not thinking of himself. He's not thinking about what he can get. He's not thinking about sexual favors. He sees her as a good and godly woman of extremely high character. And single guys, let me talk to you for a second. When you're looking for a wife, of course there needs to be physical attraction, but it goes way beyond her looks. What kind of woman will she be as a spouse and a mother? Does she care for people? Does she love God? Does she have a good work ethic? And you're like, you know, I'll figure all that out later. What I care about right now is that she's smoking hot. Let me remind you for a second. So is hell, okay? I'm so grateful in my own life that I found such a high character woman. My wife, Kim, she's incredibly beautiful. So I get a double bonus. But Kim works in an all-male business. She's around guys and only guys all day long. And I never, ever have a second thought about that. I never wonder if she's up to anything shady. Why? Because her character and her integrity is impeccable. And so Boaz is captivated by this woman's character. And he treats her with great care and respect. And what we see him do over the next couple verses, and I'm just going to summarize them, is just to be a godly man. And we know he's godly because he does the kinds of things that God would do. He protects, he provides, he honors her. He imitates to her the over-the-top way that God loves. So what you're seeing in Boaz's treatment of Ruth is the invisible hand of God in her life. He's already called her daughter. He's already told her to stay in his field. Don't go into any of the other fields. He also threatens his guys not to lay a hand on her. But then in verses 13 through 18, he lets her share a meal with him and his workers. He gives her a doggy bag to take home to Naomi. He asks his workers to pull out some of the grain of the bundles that they've already harvested and give it to her so she doesn't have to do all the work herself. So Ruth hangs around. She keeps on working until evening, and finally she makes her trip home to Naomi. And Naomi's amazed at all that's happened. And they start piecing together what will be the most providential detail of all. I want you to look at verse 19. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today, and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." And she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, and she said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. And Naomi also said to her, this man is a close relative of ours. He's one of our redeemers. Now, this is a very important detail that we're going to talk about in great detail next week. But I want to wrap up today by drawing out some truths from chapter 2, as we saw over and over again in the invisible hand of God at work. And so I want to look at three lessons about God's invisible hand of providence that we can learn from chapter 2. The first is just a repeat of our big idea today. God's invisible hand is always at work. I had you circle the word happened back in verse 3, and just write in the margin, God's providence next to that. There are so many details in this chapter that are just too perfect to be an accident. In fact, we get clues to what God is up to, especially in verse 12, when Boaz suggests that God, what God's doing here with Ruth, is he's blessing and rewarding Ruth because she sought refuge under his wings. Remember last week she said, you know, to Naomi, she said, your God is my God, and I'm going to run to him. I'm going to run to the house of bread. I'm going to run to the people of God. And she didn't know all the details of that decision, but in faith, she took that step anyway. And guys, some of us are such control freaks when it comes to our faith. We want God to be our consultant, but not our CEO. And so we say, well, God, I need to see every single detail before I trust or follow you. But guys, there are some things that we'll never understand this side of heaven. And Ruth and Naomi, they chose to seek refuge under God's care. And as soon as they did, they start seeing God work. Is it through spectacular miracles? No. It's through simple acts of providence, acts that are invisible, they're circumstantial, they're generous, they're from God's invisible hand. Providential coincidences. You know, as the saying goes, coincidence is just God's way of remaining anonymous. Think of all the coincidences in this chapter. It just so happened. It just so happened that Naomi and Ruth came back just in time for the harvest. It just so happened that Ruth walked out the door and found a random field that just so happened to belong to Boaz, who just so happened to be a worthy, godly man and a relative. And Boaz just so happened to pull up in his beamer right when he would see Ruth working. And his intern just so happened to know the whole story of who she was. And Boaz just so happened to have extra time to have lunch with her and to hear her story. And he just so happened to command his guys to help her and to be kind to her. And as we read, we get the sense that every time something just so happens a certain way, it's the invisible hand of a good God at work. And at the end of chapter 1, Naomi was convinced that God didn't care, and yet through every detail of chapter 2, God showed her that he did. Some of you find yourself in that place. You're crying out, God, give me a sign. God, show me that you're there. God, do a miracle. And he's saying, look closer. Look smaller. I'm showing up in every detail. You see, God's presence with you is supernatural, even if it's not spectacular. It may not be with a booming voice. It may not be with handwriting on a wall. But through every little detail of your story, if you listen, God is saying, I love you. I haven't forgotten you. I care about you. I'm guiding you. I'm providing for you. My strong hand is always there for you. And so God's invisible hand is always at work. The second lesson is this. You can make God's invisible hand visible by how you treat other people. You know, Ruth took a huge risk by going out into the fields, but she really had no choice. Something had to be done, or she and Naomi would starve. As a poor, single, foreign woman, she could not have been more vulnerable. All she could really count on was God's protection. And listen, Boaz became the hands and feet of God's protection. He made God's invisible hand visible to Ruth and Naomi. We see his godliness from the very first greeting and all the way through this chapter. Just as a sample, go to verse 8. In verse 8, you can underline the little phrase, keep close to my young women, and just write God's hand, be God's hand to others. A great exercise to do on your own would be to go through this chapter again and highlight all the ways that Boaz became God's hands to Ruth. You'll notice two ways that he does this, two major ways. One was through his kind words, the other was through generous actions. He offered kind words of acceptance to her from the very start. He called her my daughter. He graciously explains publicly how impressed he is by her provision for Naomi. And through his words, he's conveying, not only do I accept you, but my God accepts you as well. Do you know that you and I have this same power? Peter says in his epistle in the New Testament that as Christians, when we speak as ones who are conveying the very words of God to others. Think about that for a second. Every time you open your mouth to speak as a Christian, you are conveying the very words of God. Does it make you want to be a little bit more thoughtful about your words? But Boaz's generous actions are amazing as well. It wasn't just his words, it was his actions. From the sexual harassment policy to the provision of food, he just went over and above again and again. And there are some cultural things going on here as well. I mean, his instruction in verse 9, we didn't even cover this, but for Ruth to drink from the water that the young men have drawn, that's extraordinary. It would have been the cultural norm for foreigners to draw water for the Hebrews and for the women to draw water for the men. And so his command to his servants represents a total reversal of two cultural norms. He's saying, no, let the men do the work. Ruth, you sit here and relax. They'll give you something cool to drink. And what he's saying is you're welcomed in this community. You'll be honored. You'll be treated as equal. We will take good care of you. He offers actions of acceptance. And God's invisible acceptance becomes very real to her as a result. You realize that every single day you can make God's provision personal to vulnerable people in your life? Let me talk about immigrants just for a moment. It's heartbreaking, even infuriating to see vulnerable children being separated from their parents. And listen, there's also a security issue going on for our country that absolutely needs to be addressed at the exact same time. And without getting into all of it, here's what I want to say. Our public dialogue is great and really important. There's a big debate going on. And advocacy and demonstrations are a critical part of our freedom, okay? But my challenge to you is that if you're going to post stuff on social media or yell or march, is to make sure that you're also practicing what you preach. There is a huge immigrant and refugee population right here in Erie, Pennsylvania. A phone call down to the International Institute or another local agency to see how you could serve immigrants and their families who are displaced right here in Erie would be a fantastic outlet for you. In fact, the Serve Erie School initiative that's coming up at the beginning of August is serving Pfeiffer Burley School this year, who has a significant immigrant population in their student body. We got a chance to serve them right here, right now. Let's not just be protesters. Let's be the hands and feet of Jesus to the marginalized and the vulnerable. And beyond just immigrants, there are other people in your life all the time who are vulnerable, who are wondering if God really loves them. They're wondering if God really cares for them. And guys, a text from you, a kind word from you, an invitation to coffee from you, a generous gift from you, a compliment from you, an encouragement from you might be enough to remind them that God hasn't forgotten them. That he hasn't abandoned them, that he's still providentially looking out for them. Through you and me, God makes the work of his invisible hand visible to others in our lives through our kind words and through our generous actions. I wonder if there's someone in your life who comes to mind right now. One takeaway from today would be to reach out to them. You can make the invisible hand of God visible by how you treat others. That's the second lesson. Here's the third. God's invisible hand is active in our effort. Notice Ruth doesn't sit around and feel sorry for herself. She decides to go out and glean. And Pastor Chris Brown said it this way. He said, it's easier for God to steer a moving car than a parked car. I love that. God's providential hand rarely guides the idle and lazy. But take a step out in faith and get to work, and God can start guiding you. If Naomi and Ruth would have locked themselves in their houses and prayed for food, God feed us, God bring us food, they probably would have starved to death. But Ruth stepped out and she said, I know it's dangerous. I know I'm new around here. I know I'm a foreigner, but I'm going to see what I can find in the fields. And that initiative started a domino effect of God's provision for this little family. Now, why does God do it that way? Is he being mean? No, he wants to include us in the miracle. He wants us to participate so that our faith will grow and our influence will expand. In the midst of moving, God directs our steps. So I want you to look back at verse 12 again. Underline this little phrase that says, the Lord repay you for what you've done. And just write, God is active in our effort. Boaz says that God's blessing to Ruth was tied to all that she had done for Naomi. God responds to our faithful work. And we need to pray and we need to seek God way more than we do. But listen, I've also seen praying about it become an excuse for not doing anything. And we want to ask Ruth, how did you know which field to go to? How did you discern God's will? This is a big hot topic today. How do you know God's will for your life? Like when you walked out the door that morning, how did you know if it was God's will to go right or left? And how did you know when to stop walking and say, this is the field that I'm going to glean from? And I'll bet if Ruth could speak to us today, she would say, I have no idea. I knew my mom and I needed food. I knew he brought us here to Bethlehem. I knew that this gleaning provision was made for people like me. And so I just started walking and I started working, and look at what God did. We need to trust the invisible hand of God and take steps forward, even when we can't seem to see the next step. You know, I mentioned this painting at the beginning of the message today, and it represents where some of you find yourself today. Maybe a little like Ruth, you feel like you've come, you know, as far as you can come on your own. This is brand new territory. Maybe you're at a disadvantage. Maybe you're spiritually or emotionally or relationally or professionally starving like Naomi and Ruth were. And you're not sure where to go next. You're not sure what the next step is, but no matter what the next step is, it's going to be a step of faith. You know that. What I want to remind you of today is that it may feel like you're alone, but you're not. And it may feel like God has forgotten you, but he hasn't. And if you take refuge in Yahweh, the God of the Bible, you may not be able to see it, but his invisible hand is always there to catch you. It's always there to guide you and to carry you and to refresh you and to comfort you. His providence will never fail you. God's invisible hand is always at work. And so won't you take a minute as we wrap this up and reflect on the times when God has been there for you in the ordinary, in the people of your life, in the ways you didn't expect it. And won't you thank him now for his mighty, powerful, invisible hand in your life.